From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Caregiving at Home in the Age of Managed Healthcare, a talk with Carol Levine. She directs the United Hospital Fund's project on family caregiving and also cares for her husband, who was critically injured in an automobile accident 10 years ago. Also, we talk with the founder of Arhuli Records, Chris Strachwitz. The label specializes in regional American music and has just released a 40th anniversary box set. Rock critic Ed Ward introduces us to the almost-forgotten genre of jug band music, and film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Dancer in the Dark, the new film by Lars von Trier. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The federal government has opened a new investigation into some possibly defective Firestone tires. The Bridgestone Firestone Company is already recalling a separate line of tires that has been linked to more than 100 fatal accidents nationwide. Quinn Kleinfelder reports from member station WDET in Detroit.
The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is investigating Firestone's line of Steeltex light truck tires. Federal regulators say that they have received nearly 170 complaints about Steeltex's R4S and AT tires, including reports that the tires were involved in traffic accidents which left two people dead and a dozen injured. The tire's tread reportedly separates from its casings in much the same way as the 6.5 million ATX, ATX2, and Wilderness AT tires Firestone is already recalling. The Steeltex tires are routinely used on Ford F-250 and F-350 pickups and the Ford Excursion, as well as General Motors Suburban and G-Vans. But a spokesperson for General Motors says the company has not received any reports of problems with tires mounted on those vehicles. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
With the current fiscal year about to end tomorrow, President Clinton signed a temporary spending measure that allows the government to keep operating while Congress and the White House negotiate over the budget. The temporary measure keeps the government funded through October 6th, which is not likely to be enough time to deal with the 11 annual spending bills that still need to be completed. The measures are stalled in disputes between the White House and Congress and include such issues as a patient's bill of rights and a boost in the minimum wage. Texas Governor George W. Bush and Vice President Al Gore offered their dueling views on the nation's energy policy today. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Bush blamed the Clinton administration for rising fuel prices. He says the government has failed to encourage oil drilling in the U.S., and he says the administration has failed to pressure the U.S.'s Middle Eastern allies to keep prices down. Bush wants the U.S. to consider more drilling at home. He favors oil exploration in the vast Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. In a speech today in Maryland, Al Gore denounced that idea.
It would take years and years of development, which would cause decades of environmental damage just to reap a few months of increased oil supply.
Gore is promoting a plan to spend billions of dollars researching more efficient technologies, cars that get 80 miles to the gallon, and alternative fuels. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 173 points, or 1.6%, to close at 3,673 in active trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 106 points, or 2.8%. It closed at 3,672. This is NPR News. Israeli police and Palestinian demonstrators clashed today at Jerusalem's holiest shrine, leaving at least four Palestinians dead and dozens of people injured. The site is sacred to Jews, who know it as the Temple Mount, and to Muslims, who know it to whom it is Harum ash-Sharif. Some demonstrators reportedly began throwing stones at Israeli police as thousands of worshippers emerged from the two mosques in the walled compound. Police responded with rubber-coated bullets. The clash occurred a day after Israeli opposition leader Ariel Sharon angered many Palestinians by visiting the compound to highlight Israel's control of the site. The British Army says it's planning to withdraw more than 5,000 soldiers from Northern Ireland if the security situation continues to improve. The move is part of an overall program of demilitarization. Marianne McGuire reports from Belfast.
5,500 British soldiers could be sent back to England if the security situation continues to improve. The Chief of the Northern Ireland Police also announced plans to cut a number of the current 64 military bases. The announcement comes days after Irish Republicans launched a new diplomatic offensive aimed at speeding up demilitarisation in Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin has given a qualified welcome to what the party said was small moves, but pro-British unionists have reacted angrily. They say it is too early because the threat from dissident Irish Republican groups still exists. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Belfast.
Shares in Apple Computer fell sharply today after the company warned its fourth quarter earnings will be lower than expected. The computer company's stock fell by 52%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Rockefeller Brothers Fund, providing support for NPR cultural programming through a Charles E. Culpepper Endowment Grant.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Carol Levine is one of many home health caregivers who has changed her life to care for a sick loved one. Her husband was totally incapacitated by an automobile accident 10 years ago. She's faced countless frustrations with the medical bureaucracy while dealing with her own constant exhaustion. But Levine is also a professional in the fields of medical ethics and health policy. So when she looks at her problems with home health care, she sees how it's symptomatic of problems with the larger healthcare system and asks what needs to be changed. And that's what she's devoting herself professionally to now. Levine directs the Families and Healthcare Project of the United Hospital Fund, which is creating model programs designed to help family caregivers. She's the editor of the new book, Always on Call, about home health care, and she's one of the speakers next week at the White House Forum on Technologies for Successful Aging. Earlier in her career, she was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship for her work in AIDS policy and ethics. Terry spoke with Carol Levine last winter.
You've said that the old-fashioned sense of family caregiving, chicken soup and fluffing pillows, really doesn't apply to what's happening today. What kind of medical care is the family caregiver expected to provide today?
Well, many family caregivers are expected to provide really what we would ordinarily consider skilled nursing care, monitoring feeding tubes, mechanical ventilators, changing dressings, doing chemotherapy, as well as the sorts of skills that require technical knowledge, like turning a paralyzed patient in bed. Those are things that were formerly done by professionals but are now being done by family members without much training.
You've written, "I feel abandoned by a healthcare system that commits resources and rewards to rescuing the injured and ill, but then consign such patients and their families to the black hole of chronic custodial care." Now, this is what happened to you.
This is exactly what happened to me. My husband and I were in an automobile accident in January 1990, so it's almost 10 years. And in the beginning, the things that American medicine does so well, trauma medicine, saving lives, really miraculous sorts of things, all came into play. But then when it became apparent that he was never going to recover completely, that they weren't going to be able to restore him to a full functioning individual, then everybody drifted away. And the custodial care is a term that insurers and others use to indicate a kind of, we don't want to deal with you anymore. You're just custodial. We can't help you. You go and take care of it. And I felt, because of that tremendous interest in the beginning and that terrific amount of energy that went into saving his life, that people would be there to help me deal with his state when he was released from rehab. But essentially, I was told, you know, so long, you're on your own. And that meant from everybody. So I truly felt abandoned. And I'm not the only one. Many people feel this sense of abandonment when doctors and the medical system can't cure and people are left with trying to live, not to live with a long-term chronic illness or disability.
What kind of shape was your husband left in, physically, mentally, emotionally?
Well, he's essentially quadriplegic. He has had some significant brain injury from the trauma. He was in a coma for 5 months, and at his age, he was then 62. People don't come out of comas the way you see in the movies and wake up and say, oh, what happened to me? It was a very, very chaotic, disturbed experience, and he was emotionally, truly unable to understand what happened and cope with his new situation. He had a lot of physical problems and a lot of mental problems as a result. Right now, he's quite stable at home, and he's certainly not the same person he was before the accident, but I've managed to get him to a state where he needs 24-hour care, but he's not in those terrible emotional upheavals.
But when you got him home and started to care for him, he was an emotional
upheaval. Oh, he was screaming all night. He wouldn't let the aides come near him. It was horrible. It was just horrible. I thought I would never survive the first 2 months. And there were many, many undiagnosed problems. He had a very severe sleep apnea. You know, he would fall asleep and stop breathing, and then he'd wake up screaming. Well, that was attributed to sort of willful bad behavior on his part when he was in the facility. And it took a long time to diagnose and treat, and that's much more under control. But I really was left with no one to kind of help me through that whole process. In fact, I did have called on a colleague who saw me and said, boy, you look awful. And I said, yeah, well, you come to my house and you'll see why I look awful. And she is treats cancer patients. And she said, I can send you someone who can try to figure out what's happening in your house. And she sent a psychiatrist and a nurse, one visit only. They said, oh, well, we can figure out something here. Your husband needs different medications and we need a different kind of environment. And they put me on the right road to straightening it out. Without them, I don't know where I would be today or where he would be. But that was because I knew somebody. That wasn't because it was part of my husband's treatment. It was really just because I happened to be in the healthcare world and know a lot of people who have different expertise. So it's very much hit or miss whether you actually get the kind of support and help you need to sort out the situation. And then had found better home care help and was able to more or less stabilize the situation, although there have been many, many ups and downs. And as I sit here today, everything is fine, but I could go home this evening and there'd be, you know, some crisis that I can't anticipate. So it's a very, very, very fragile situation. I think many caregivers feel always on the edge, and that's why we're so reluctant to leave the person to do the sorts of things that are given as advice. Take a vacation, do something for yourself. You always feel as though you really need to be very close and just monitor what's going on, even if you're not doing it all yourself.
What are some of the different stages you've gone through in terms of how much of your life you should give up to care for your husband? Should you quit your job? Should you stop seeing friends or stop going out or stop going on vacations?
Well, I early on decided, and I guess it wasn't even really a decision. I knew that I was working at a job I really liked and that was very important. I was then director of the Citizens Commission on AIDS in New York City. I did not consider giving up my job, although many people told me that's what I would have to do, both to spend down to get on Medicaid so I could get some home care for him and to preserve, I couldn't manage to take care of him and work. I early on decided that I would have to work. I needed the income and I needed the stimulation of being able to be out of the home. And from a very practical point of view, I physically can't do the kinds of lifting and moving that is required for him. So there would have to be somebody there anyway. What I found most distressing was not the kind of well-meaning, oh, it's too hard for you, you can't you know, you can't manage a job and this caregiving that you do at night. But the kind of pressure I was getting from the insurance company and from social workers that I had to quit my job and go on Medicaid. And I felt that was wrong from an ethical point of view. I thought that was wrong. I was willing to work. I was willing to produce. I was willing to be a taxpayer. And somehow the idea that the only way you could get any help was to become impoverished just struck me as very insidious. So I never did it. Now, the friends and the going out and the vacations, well, that just sort of drifted away. I mean, I see friends occasionally. I haven't taken a vacation really in 10 years, but I travel for my job. I try to make those away from homes as pleasant as possible. There are many things that I can do that I enjoy. There's a kind of disconnect now between my life and my friends and the kind of ordinary things that people do, even if they're not, you know, very extensive or glamorous, just taking a walk. I mean, those are things that I have to think about. Can I do it now? And what time do I have to be back? All that.
Our guest is Carol Levine. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview Terry Gross recorded last winter with Carol Levine. She's a healthcare policy expert specializing in long-term care.
At what point did you realize that the problems of a family caregiver were bigger and more systemic than your personal problem, and it required a new set of ethical and policy decisions?
It took me 5 years to come to the realization that it was not me that was the problem. I was doing everything that I could. I was trying to do everything right, and that it was the system that was out of order. And I started talking to some of my colleagues, and then in one conversation when somebody said, well, you know, what's new in medical ethics these days? I said, you know, there's got to be some way of looking at what the healthcare evolution in terms of the payers and in terms of cost containment is doing to families. All the talk is about what it's doing to hospitals, what it's doing to doctors. But has anybody looked at what it's doing to families by pushing all of this care and responsibility onto them? And from that point on, I was able to engage a number of colleagues in discussions, and they all said, oh, yeah, you know, we never thought about it that way. And so after some planning, I agreed to join the United Hospital Fund in New York City, which is a very well-established philanthropy and research organization, to create a new project that would do just that, to look at the impact on family caregivers of the changes in the healthcare system. And that started in October 1996. So it took me a long time. I really saw it as my personal failure rather than a systemic failure. And now I mean, maybe I missed something wrong, but the system is surely doing more wrong than just treating me this way.
Let's look at some of the systemic problems that are affecting family caregivers. First of all, how do you think managed care is affecting what families face?
Well, managed care certainly did not create the problems, but managed care has, I believe, exacerbated the problems, made it more difficult, because the effort to contain costs by keeping people at home, not in hospitals, having early discharges, and cutting costs in every other way has shifted all of the responsibilities that used to be taken by professionals to family members. So it's a kind of speeding up of what happened, what was happening before. At the same time, there has been an explosion in high-tech home care all the kinds of machines and procedures that can be done at home. So there's a whole other industry that is pressing to have services delivered at home. And to be truthful, most people would rather be at home than in a hospital. So for the most part, families are truly pitching in and trying to do the best they can, but without much help and without understanding that they, in a sense, are the bedrock of the healthcare system. They are providing all of those services that make the healthcare system profitable for those who profit and run for those who are in the nonprofit world.
And, of course, families are doing this for free. You estimate that the economic value of family caregiving is, which isn't compensated, is about 19% of the total national health care expenditure?
The economic value of free family caregiver labor, if it were counted in the health care enterprise, would make that trillion-dollar figure go up by $200 billion. So it's a tremendous amount of free labor. I think of myself as a healthcare provider, but an unpaid one. And if we were organized, 25 million Americans, about three quarters of them women, if we were organized as a labor force, we would get a lot more attention than we do. But we think of ourselves as wives and mothers and daughters, and we are that too. But we're also providing a very, very significant amount of free labor to the healthcare economy. And that should be recognized. It's not necessarily should be recognized in being paid, but in being considered and being part of the planning process and not being just expected to do everything that that nobody else wants to pay for.
What are some of the ways you want the family caregiver to be included in decision-making and consulted with by doctors?
Well, when people go home from the hospital, there is something called discharge planning. And in the old days, in the good old days, so-called, there was a social worker who would sit down with the family and say, well, who can come in and help and for how long? And let me see if I can get this and that for you. And try to understand what the family situation is. And the person going home would not be going home until they were really pretty well. And so the situation was not as acute. Now it's a very haphazard, flurried process of just signing papers. Often the discharge planners will present a family with an option, and that's the only one. You have to take your mother home today, or she has to go to a nursing home tomorrow, and the only one that we can find available is 100 miles away, those sorts of things. So if the family is involved and can pursue all of the different options and take a little time to make sure that the situation that they're setting up is the best one possible, they will be able to sustain it longer. Time and time again, I hear of situations where family members take their patient home, and within 2 days, the patient is back in the emergency room because the family didn't know how to handle what was going on or was unprepared. And that's a very costly way to take care of patients. So it really would be cost productive to give a little more time before discharge, try to set up a plan that has a chance of working, and train people to recognize when the emergency room is necessary and when you ought to be able to handle it on your own. So we don't have this kind of in and out process that is very, very destructive both to the family and to the patient.
You said that the healthcare system needs to respect the limits of what responsibilities families can actually assume. You've done focus groups with caregivers. What are some of the most common things that caregivers say they want from the system?
In our focus groups, the caregivers said the primary thing they wanted was more information. Information about the patient's condition, about resources in the community, about how to navigate the system. They also wanted recognition of the important role they play in the patient's care and patient's life. They wanted advocacy to help them navigate the system. And some of them did say, I want a little time off. And they didn't mean a year. They meant an afternoon. So those are the things they mentioned.
When they say they want recognition, they don't want like a plaque. What do they want?
They want the healthcare professionals to acknowledge them as important to the patient's care and important to the patient's life, so that they're included in discussions about what's going to happen, so that they're given information about what is likely to be the prognosis, that they are seen as part of the care team, not just as the person who brings the patient to the office. That's really what they want. They want to be included. And because, not only because they're important to the patient's care, they want to be included because what decisions are made affect them. I know that one doctor who I met was not in my case. At one meeting, a doctor was waxing enthusiastic about home care. We can turn the home into a laboratory for training medical students. Well, that's my living room. You're turning into a laboratory for medical students. Recognize that my home is my private space, and that what you bring in and the machinery and all of that stuff affects my life and the life of the rest of my family.
I want to get back to your situation at home. You've been caring for your husband since 1990, when he became a quadriplegic after a car accident that left him in a coma for 5 months and affected him on every level. How much help do you have at home now?
I have an aide who's with him every day when I go to work, and several hours on Saturday and Sunday to get him up and put him back to bed. Essentially, I'm the nighttime nurse, unless I have to travel, and then I have one of the aides stay over, and I pay for that myself. No government help or insurance help for that.
Not qualified for that?
No.
And you think you should be?
Yeah, I think I should get some help. I think I damn well should get some help, excuse me, Terry. But hey, you know, otherwise, if we spend down and he goes into a nursing home and Medicaid pays for it, everybody pays for it. I'm willing to pay for most of it, but a little help wouldn't be so bad.
Well, Carol Levine, thank you very much for sharing some of your ideas with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Carol Levine is the editor of Always on Call, a new book about family caregivers. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from Saab, featuring an all-turbocharged lineup, with safety features like the Saab Active Head Restraint System, saabusa.com. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books, publisher of Yoga and the Quest for the True Self by Stephen Cope, now in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Zydeco music from Clifton Chenier. Coming up, we talk about documenting American regional music with record producer and folklorist Chris Strachwitz. Ed Ward introduces us to the music of jug bands, and Henry Sheehan reviews Dancer in the Dark, the new Lars von Trier film. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Chris Strachwitz is the president and founder of Arhuli Records, an independent label devoted to regional American music, such as Cajun, Tex-Mex, blues, and country. Strachwitz has traveled around America recording musicians in their homes, as well as in clubs and in the studio. This month, Strachwitz received a National Heritage Fellowship Award from the National Endowment for the Arts, the nation's highest honor in the folk and traditional arts. And Arhuli Records has just released The Journey of Chris Strachwitz, a 40th anniversary box set. Though he devoted all of his adult life to the recording of indigenous music of the U.S., Strachwitz was actually born in Germany and moved to California in 1947. When Terry spoke to him in 1990, he said he first heard the music of the American South on the radio.
I think that was my first exposure to all of it. And I was absolutely wiped out by it. I guess I had a lot of insecure feelings. I couldn't speak the language. I was real skinny. And somehow the blues that I heard, I think, spoke to me the strongest. I'll never forget that first record by Lightning Hopkins. I heard, "Hello, Central, please give me 209. I want to talk to my baby. She's way on down the line." And it just blew me away. And I also loved hillbilly music. I heard T-Texas Tyler, the Maddox Brothers and Rose. And gospel music. I heard the St. Paul Baptist Church Choir over a station out of Los Angeles. All of that, you know, it was just, the radio was my ear to the world, so to speak. And I think part of my love affair with this music has been my love affair with meeting these other cultures.
When you started collecting records, where did you go to get them? I mean, I think a lot of people thought of 78s as junk, that they'd just sell in flea markets or give them away.
Well, that was at that time the only kind of record. That was the only one in existence. It was a marvelous medium. And it turned out almost every kind of vernacular music was recorded. And I found out it slowly. I didn't have any money, but I would save my allowances. And once in a while, I could splurge and buy myself a 78. And I would wear them out, I can tell you that.
What made you decide to try to record people and meet the people whose records you were listening to and record new records by them?
Well, since I was so enamored with this whole idea of records and what's on them, you know, I always collected things and stamps before that, but records, you could hear what's in those grooves. And I guess I was simply amazed by it all. And when I came up here to Northern California, I met people like Bob Geddens, a black man originally from Texas who was recording here in the Bay Area. And then I met a man named Jackson. He lived on 7th Street in West Oakland. He was recording literally in his back room with one microphone and a disc cutter, you know, where you cut directly to disc. Those early 78s were all done that way. And I simply was amazed that this is all it takes. I first thought to make a record, you go into one side of a factory of a huge place, an artist goes in, and out on the other side come the records. But I had no idea what the in-between process was. And sort of meeting all these people taught me.
Some of the early music that you recorded was Zydeco music in Louisiana, at house parties, in bars. I want to play one of those early sessions. But before I play it, tell us what Zydeco is and how it's distinguished from, say, Cajun music.
Yeah, I didn't know what Zydeco music was either when I first went down there in 1960 or 59, so I simply asked people, what does Zydeco mean? And some of them said, well, it means snap beans, not salty. It's an old tune that everybody knew. Others said, oh, it's just going out in the country and having a party, going to the Zydeco, going to party and having a good time playing music, push and pull, you know, that accordion music. And so that's basically what it is. It's the music of the French-speaking Creoles, blacks, in southwest Louisiana, in contrast to the white Cajun music.
Now, I want to play something that you made in the early 1960s. This is called Tap Dance. It's by a group, McZeal and Gergner. Tell us where you recorded this, who they are.
Well, I'm really not too sure who they were. At that time, I was just wandering around and just asking people. You know, I was driving. And they said, oh, yeah, I met them somehow through someone else. And they said, we're playing a little house party. Come on over and join us, you know. And so I did. I simply went to this little house in Lafayette, I believe it was. And they played for me, and there was a bunch of people having a good time at the house. And they were very typical of the little Zydeco groups that were all over the place, usually just accordion and rubboard. In Houston...
Rubboard is like washboard?
Yeah, like a washboard. And at that time, they were still pretty much looked like a washboard. I later found out that some of them would take pieces out of an old icebox where there was corrugated steel in them, and they would cut out a piece that they can scrape on. Because the regular old washboard, see, that metal is much too soft. It just wears through in no time when you're scraping away on it with beer can openers and all that sort of stuff. So they were using a corrugated metal, steel metal, right off the bat. And now it's become a real fashionable instrument that was sort of invented by Clifton Chenier, or by his brother Cleveland Chenier, who was really one of the giants of the whole genre. And they went down to a guy once, Clifton told me, he said, I went down to the steel company and told him, can you make me one like this? And he said he drew it in the sand as to how he wanted it, with this collar on it that would fold back over his shoulders, you know, and then hanging in front of his chest. And they said, sure, we can make that. And that's how these rub boards were made that you see now being worn by almost all the rub board players.
Well, let's go to this 1961 recording that you made at a house party in Lafayette, Louisiana. Recorded in 1961 by my guest Chris Drakwitz, who's the founder and head of Arhuli Records, which is a record company that features regional music from around America and also music from other parts of the world. Had there been much Cajun and Zydeco music recordings made before you started making them in the early 60s?
Oh, yes, lots of them. Not much in the way of black recordings, no, but a lot of the first Cajun recording was made in 1928 by Joe Falcon. But in subsequent years, relatively little black material was recorded, except Alan Lomax did some extraordinary field work in the early 30s. But it wasn't a commercial entity, and really until about that time. And Clifton Chenier had already had a hit by the time I met him, but the one hit had sort of worn out when I met him, and he was absolutely almost insisting that I record him, and he wanted to get a record out back on the jukeboxes, because that was their meal ticket, you know. So he was really the main one that I recorded, because I wasn't sure if I could sell that type of thing. I met Clifton through Lightning Hopkins. They are cousins, you see. And I wasn't sure if I could sell it. I knew I could sell blues, because my European clientele had already told me, you know, oh, we love these blues. And I was beginning to get an inkling of that, because I was selling old 78s to Europe. That's how I actually made my first money, to buy a tape recorder and stuff. But the other things, the French music, I wasn't too sure at all about.
Chris Drakwitz from a 1990 interview with Terry Gross. He is the founder of Arhuli Records, which has just released a 40th anniversary box set, The Journey of Chris Drakwitz. More after the break. This is Fresh Air. Chris Drakwitz is my guest, and we're talking about regional music in the United States, which is what he records on his Arhuli record label. Let's play something by Fred McDowell. Now, this is also one of the early recordings that you made. He was a Mississippi blues guitarist and singer, and probably the most famous record that you recorded of his is You Gotta Move, which was later covered by the Rolling Stones.
Well, I guess that's the one that became famous because they did it, you know. And he was an extraordinary person. I was wiped away when I heard the Alan Lomax collection from Mississippi. And I remember I wrote to Alan Lomax, where is this man from? And he gave me an address in Clarksdale, Mississippi, and I went to the post office. Where's Route so-and-so? He said, oh, it's out there, north of Highway 61. Go out there. And I met him just getting off a tractor, and I recorded that record there the same night. Not this particular one, but that first album. I don't think he sang You Got to Move on that first night we recorded, but what a wonderful person, Fred McDowell. He loved his music, and he was just as passionate about it as anybody I've ever encountered. And he would play on. If you meet him, he didn't care if he's getting paid or not. He loved what he was doing. It was just a sheer joy, that man.
Let me play something that you recorded by him in 1965. This is You Gotta Move.
You got to move, you got to move, you got to move, child, you got to move. But when they law, get ready, you got to move.
Fred McDowell singing You've Gotta Move. Now, this is a song attributed to Fred McDowell. Is it ever hard to tell who actually wrote a song, a blues song? Because there seems to be so many permutations of more or less the same song. And I found in books that I read that sometimes songs are attributed to different people, depending on who you're reading.
It's a real problem. In that particular instance, it's a traditional song, but the arrangement is by Fred McDowell. Reverend Gary Davis also had a very distinctive arrangement of it. But you sort of remind me of the fact that, you know, as I got into this whole music thing, one slowly begins to realize what responsibilities one has. And that was one of the early ones I think I encountered. This whole business of copywriting, because when you're recording someone, or you're really capturing some of their talent, or you're capturing some of their ideas. People who write books, you know, okay, they go to a publisher and they have their books written and copywrote and all that. But these vernacular musicians don't, and so you're really responsible for protecting them. And I learned this really primarily from a good old buddy down in South Louisiana, Eddie Schuler. He once heard my tapes, you know. I played them to him, and he says, Chris, what do you want that stuff for? Get their songs. I said, what do you mean, get their songs? I got them right there on the tape. No, man, that ain't what I'm talking about. Copyrights. Get their copyrights. If Frank Sinatra or the Beatles want to make a big hit out of it, you know, then if you got the copyright, that's where you make the money, and you share that with the composer. So I kind of learned that, you know. You don't read that in books, but you begin to realize what responsibilities you have in life.
Chris Strachwitz, founder of Arhuli Records, which has just issued a 40th anniversary boxed set collection of regional music. Rock historian Ed Ward has been listening to a collection of classic recordings from the 1920s and 30s that feature another distinctly American music genre, the jug band.
The jug band was born out of the impulse to make music with anything you had at hand. The name itself comes from the bass instrument, a ceramic or metal jug played by buzzing the lips over the opening, although other devices, including stovepipes, were also used. Kazoos, nose flutes, clarinets, guitars, fiddles, and harmonicas, anything went in the jug band. The most famous ones, the ones that made the most recordings anyway, were in Memphis. Cannon's Jug Stoppers featured the banjo talents of Gus Cannon, a Medicine Show veteran, and Noah Lewis's harmonica. Minglewood blues, like Cannon, had a long life, showing up in the repertoire of the Grateful Dead, while Cannon actually saw some money in the early 60s when the Rooftop Singers had a hit with Walk Right In, a song he'd recorded in the 30s. About Jack Kelly and the South Memphis Jug Band, not much other than their names is known, although RFC Blues shows Kelly was a fine vocalist. And harmonica virtuoso Jed Davenport had from time to time Memphis Minnie and her husband Joe McCoy and his Beale Street Jug Band. All of these bands formed because of the undisputed king of jug bands, though, the Memphis Jug Band.
Do that thing, Bob. Oh, that Fourth Street mess around.
Oh, mess around, mess around, mess around.
Originated. Anybody about that brand new dance, the gals will say, you're going my way, it's right here for you, and here's your only chance. Denny.
Led by Will Shade, a guitarist, and with a changing cast of characters, the Memphis Jug Band was famous for its popularity with black and white audiences, and for its unpredictable stage antics. They left behind over 40 records during their career, with songs about everything from cocaine addiction to unfaithful women to spiders. But jug bands weren't really a Memphis institution, it turns out. The first ones to record came from Louisville, Kentucky. The Dixieland Jug Blowers had recorded behind blues singer Sarah Martin in 1924, and the record executives decided they needed their own session. Banjorino, which we just heard, is a later recording, one of many they made. Kentucky Jug Band was another Louisville group, and the Walkin' Cane Stomp was a showstopper, since the flute you hear was also a cane used in the dance numbers. And while the Memphis bands incorporated a lot of blues into their repertoires, Most jug bands walk the line between jazz and ragtime. Whistler's Jug Band's Jug Band Special is a perfect example. Like most other specialized music, jug band music disappeared from the recording scene with the advent of the Depression, although jug bands could be seen on the streets of Memphis right into the 50s. Revived during the folk era of the 60s, jug band music is a real milestone in the American tradition of improvisation and a hotbed of wild and crazy music.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He played music from Ruckus Juice and Chitlins, Volumes 1 and 2. Coming up, a review of the new Lars von Trier film. This is Fresh Air. Dancer in the Dark is the new film by Danish director Lars von Trier. It stars Icelandic singer Björk, who performs her own music, Catherine Deneuve, and American actors David Morse and Joel Grey. Von Trier is best known here for his film Breaking the Waves with Emily Watson. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
Dancer in the Dark is such an oddball movie that it's hard to pick an angle to come at it. It's a downbeat musical, stylistic turning point for the filmmaker, an acting triumph for a non-actor. And like the majority of films by Lars von Trier, it's about a female saintly self-abnegation for the sake of a male. Selma, a Czech immigrant to the United States, works in a Washington State tool and die plant in 1964, alongside her best friend, a French woman, played by Catherine Deneuve. To add to the national confusion, Selma is played by the Icelandic singer Björk, and the movie was shot in Denmark. Selma is a quiet, self-effacing woman, and so is Björk's performance for the first 20 minutes or so. Wearing thick glasses, dressed in frumpy clothes, and half hidden by the industrial press that turns aluminum plates into tubs, Selma is the quintessentially mousy immigrant, a familiar figure to anyone who has ever worked a factory floor. Selma is going blind and becoming increasingly sensitive to sound. The rhythms of the machinery provoke a musical fantasy in her mind, which soon takes over the screen. This will happen again and again throughout the movie, as the clickety-clack of a train or even the scratches on a record form the rhythmic basis of a musical number. Music becomes the medium through which Björk builds a heart-piercing performance. This isn't the sour contrast of reality and musical fantasy that made up Pennies from Heaven. In Dancer in the Dark, the musical segments create not an alternate, but supplemental reality, where Selma can express truths about herself, truths she cannot speak otherwise. Selma and her boy Gene live in a small house on property owned by a local policeman and his wife. They, along with Deneuve and another factory worker with a yen for Selma, know that she doesn't have much money, and so pitch in to buy Gene his first bike for his 10th birthday.
It's about the bike.
The bike?
The bike.
I cannot give Gene a bike. Is this his idea?
It was not his idea.
No.
Gene?
Yeah?
Did you ask him to come over?
No.
No, he didn't.
He doesn't know anything, Selma, frankly.
Why, have I done something?
No. I haven't got the money.
But I'm almost the only kid in class who doesn't have a bike.
I'm just not that kind of mother, Georgina.
Can't you be that kind of a mother?
We'll see. We'll see, Mr. G.
Careful!
This scene, along with many to follow, challenge our notion of charity. Not just giving to the poor, but charity in a larger religious and philosophical sense, in which moral obligation, rather than whim, dictates giving. This preoccupation has always marked von Trier as a religious filmmaker, moral rather than moralistic, despite the violence and sex which populate his films. Selma, we learn, is atoning for a selfish act, bringing Jean into the world in the first place. He will inherit her eye disease, and so Selma has moved to the U.S., works day and night, and saves every penny for the sake of a vision-saving operation for her son. But she has resolved to tell absolutely no one what she's doing. This leads to operatic complications and a tragic climax. Von Trier is a leader of the Dogma Group, which in the mid-1990s promulgated an artistic declaration. Films would be shot on handheld video cameras with as little contrivance as possible. Now, von Trier exposes this lack of contrivance as merely another contrivance. Video images are nearly square when they are first filmed, and in Dancer, von Trier composes images tightly to that square. But when these same images are blown up and distorted to fit the rectangular screen, a distancing effect takes hold. On the other hand, the musical sequences are composed to fit that rectangular shape. 5 years after rejecting the notion of composition altogether, von Trier is making tentative moves back towards tradition. He is not spurning the Dogma experiments, but integrating them as his movie moves between Selma's daily life and her musical or spiritual life. Von Trier's efforts are not nearly so costly as his heroines, but they are, in their way, as daring.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
I've seen it all. I have seen the trees. I have seen the willow leaves dancing in the breeze.
I've seen a man killed by his best friend and lives that were over before they were spent. I've seen what I was and I know what I'll be. I've seen it all. There is no more to see.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Expanded Quotable Einstein, available in bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, author Mary Carr. She wrote the best-selling memoir, The Liars Club, about her life as a young girl growing up in East Texas. Her new memoir, Cherry, chronicles her turbulent teen years. Join us for the next Fresh Air.